Hello, my name is Anna DeVries. I'm a private investigator with 10 years experience finding missing people. The following program came to my attention from a fellow colleague and investigator. This colleague's work had taken many strange and unprecedented turns over the course of our professional relationship. When I heard that there was a group of alleged killers she was investigating and that they had a podcast, I was frankly in disbelief. I was awoken one night by my phone, which buzzed as a series of texts and emails came into my inbox. It was too late for such a barrage of emails. Usually, such a data dump by another investigator meant one thing: they were in danger. Immediately, I read through what she sent me. In email after email, she detailed the scope of her work as it spanned 13 states. Attached to the emails were audio files, security camera footage, crime scene photographs, screenshots of online forums, geotagged maps, and her own extensive notes. In a postscript, she said, "I'm sorry to drag you into this, but I don't know who else to tell, and time is short. They found me." I sent her one of our stock text messages that we use when we're trying to determine if the other needs help. This message includes a pattern of emojis that she is supposed to respond to with a specific corresponding pattern to show that she is okay. After two tense hours, I received her reply that she was okay. At least for the moment. Now, I should explain that my colleague performs a personal risk assessment before she begins her work. To ensure the safety of herself, her family, and her team, she evaluates every case before she takes it on, checking off boxes of inherent risk. The list that she uses is, in short, comprehensive. In her emails that night, she said, "From what I've seen, this one has a much larger risk profile. Every box is checked." That was 6 months ago. She is now a missing person in the state of Pennsylvania. I am continuing her investigation, and I would like to present these recordings to, well, everyone, in the hopes that someone out there has information. This is a recording of a program that was discovered in the spring of 2021 by a user named BiloxiBuns405B, which was then subsequently passed along to law enforcement agencies and myself. The podcast was linked to a dark web forum that will be kept unknown for the sake of this investigation. What follows is a podcast produced for a dedicated following of 40 individuals. Who knows what these 40 usernames represent? People, groups of listeners, bots operating on some unknown agenda. What we know about the audience is that they are steadfast in their listenership. Each episode is downloaded 40 times within minutes of its airing. To anyone who's listening, familiarize yourselves with their voices so that you might be able to recognize them if ever your paths meet. And please, if there is a detail that stands out that could give a better understanding of their whereabouts, contact me. Don't become complacent in the safety of your routines. I ask you this out of desperation. Be on the lookout.
Welcome again to Last Scene. Connie and Ronnie here, your humble hosts, the demonic duo.
The devilish duet.
The pernicious pair.
A brace of bastards.
The dubious doublet.
The unwholesome twosome.
The terrible twins.
A couple of cool guys.
Bring to our fine fans true tales of murder most foul.
Murder most foul! We are the slithering worm that infects the underbelly of this roiling hellscape.
Tonight's story buries you 1,000 feet under the earth. Enjoy the Mind Piper. I don't know.
Maybe
about the
not
title.
The Mind Piper, yeah. It's a little suggestive.
What should it be?
The Crevice Creeper.
We'll work on the title.
I don't know. There's something about being this close to the town in the woods, which is scarier than if we were really deep in the backwoods. Do you understand? You get that?
In some way, I do get that. But I think being really isolated in the woods can be super creepy as well.
But you're less likely to run into a person when you're really deep in the backwoods. I feel like running into people, for me, is scarier than running into wildlife.
I agree. But when you run into a person, when you're that deep in the woods, is way creepier than... If we ran into a person now, it wouldn't be that creepy because we're like, oh, we're right near the town. You know, there's probably some other people who could be camping here but just got here late, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
For instance, do you remember that time I went on that backpacking trip to Maine?
Yeah, it was like 6 years ago.
Yeah, five, six years ago. So we did the 100-mile wilderness, which, as you know, is the most desolate stretch of the Appalachian Trail. And when we started this trail, you know, it's at the end of a county road, then a dirt road to the parking lot. So the parking lot is already out there. And then we're 50 miles of a hike, 2 days hike into this thing. We're making camp for the night. It's dusk. The light's getting gray. We're exhausted. We're not sleeping in tents. We're sleeping in our sleeping bags on mats because it was a nice night. And right as it's getting almost dark, you know, the woods are cast in a soft gray light. Some guy just walks down the trail.
Walks right past you?
He was about, you know, 50 feet off. You know, we're probably 50 feet off the trail. Mm. And he just walks by. And my friend Andy, he calls out to him, says, "Hey, how's it going?" And the guy doesn't respond. And it's freaking us out because, I mean, he didn't have a backpack. He wasn't even really dressed for a hike. He was just wearing a collared shirt, khaki pants, and shoes. And we're 50 miles into this trail. We didn't encounter another party the entire time we'd been hiking. So we're thinking he could be one of two things. He could be from another party that's ahead of us, that's going the other way, right? And he just walked away for some private time. But we didn't see anybody the next day. No one passed us on the trail going the opposite direction. So the other thing we thought was, this is a guy who just lives out there in the woods. He's halfway into the 100-mile wilderness, and that's just where he hangs out all the time.
Wait, so he didn't have a backpack or anything on?
He didn't have a headlamp. He didn't have a backpack. That was the freakiest part, that he didn't have a headlamp, because it was a clear night, but when you're under that dense of a canopy, it's pretty dark. So either he was walking to a campsite not far away, or he knew it that well in the dark that he didn't need a headlamp. And that was pretty unsettling. So obviously we didn't sleep at all that night. And the next day, like I said, didn't encounter another party on the trail. Didn't see anyone else the entire time. Finished out the trip. It took about 4 days. And we were the only ones on it the entire time that we saw other than that one guy.
Do you think he was a hermit?
I don't know what else he could be. I mean, how could he be 50 miles in? I mean, he wasn't running. He wasn't an ultra marathon runner. He was just walking casually down the trail, ignoring us. Or possibly ignoring us.
Hey, somebody's coming.
A little late to be claiming your campsite. Right?
What are they doing?
It's probably teenagers smoking weed.
It looked like three guys in the car when they passed.
Hey, they're coming back around. You brought your axe? Okay, back to business. Are you ready to record?
Yeah.
All right, whenever you're good.
Okay. We're here tonight, camping in the woods of West Virginia,
to visit the site of the Sheep's Head mining disaster. The Sheep's Head mining disaster is one that is mired with superstition and dread in the town of Owasquin, West Virginia. Its existence is well known to local residents, though it fails to make it into any historical record. It seems clear that the residents of Harrison County have worked hard to suppress the information around the event. The story of the mining disaster is all the stranger, because there was no physical mining incident that caused the deaths. We've gathered the story over 10 years from 6 local residents, 3 of whom were infants at the time, but were told the story by their parents and those few survivors. As the story goes, on April 3rd, 1931, a mining group was working its way through a drift of coal when they emerged into an open cavity. When they broke through the wall into this open space, they were concerned, as the integrity of the mine had been called into question many times before then. The opening to the cavity was shored up with extra supports before the miners began to progress into the chamber. This was the 30s, remember, and worker safety was not high in the priority of the mine owners, in this case a family group, the Hacklands. What the miners told their overseer at the time, which he later related to his daughter, they thought this was the end of the drift. But as they continued in their exploratory digging, they found that the cavity was a much larger space. One miner described the space to his wife later that night as a high-ceilinged chamber. Their echoes, he said, had a significant delay, highlighting the vastness of the space. The rock floor was, to their further surprise, fairly even. Gas lamps were brought in as they searched the walls for the continuation of the coal seam they had been working on. So this is where the story becomes a little confusing. The miners reported that they followed the wall of the cavity for what seemed to be an eighth to a quarter of a mile when they made their first discovery. At the far end of the cavity, the miners found the start of another drift tunnel. They followed this tunnel 40 feet in and found a collapse. Mixed into the rubble were blast caps for nitroglycerin. This was odd, since nitroglycerin hadn't been used in mines for about 50 years, since the arrival of dynamite. And from what the miners could see, the drift tunnel had not collapsed naturally. It had been closed with explosives. This raised many questions. The Hackland operation had never been to that area, and the foremans were not aware of any other mining operations, at least not on that side of the mountain. So who dug out that drift tunnel, and why did they collapse it? And why had the tunnel, by all appearances, been closed from the inside? The blockage was completely impassable, requiring more tracks and equipment to clear it. The miners were completely exhausted, having worked for 18 hours, so they turned back for the day. Instead of following the outer wall back the way they came in, to save time they crossed through the center of the chamber, moving toward the light of their lamps at the entrance. As they walked, one man stumbled into a shallow pit. It appeared to be at the center of the chamber. The pit was described as roughly round and smoothed out like a bowl. Scattered about the pit were what one miner described as a multitude of skeletal remains. It was unclear to the miners how many dead were represented in this pile. Concerned for their safety, they spoke briefly amongst themselves and decided it best to notify the foreman and to halt operations until the integrity of this new area was determined. Now, there were multiple fears represented in the discovery of these remains. They worried about gas intrusion and death from asphyxiation. They worried about the physical stability of the mine and whether the collapse in the old drift tunnel was what had trapped these miners inside. Though water penetration had been a concern in other areas of the mine, they had no evidence of it here. Fearing they had little time to waste, they moved towards the entrance to the chamber. As they made their way back, they came upon a young boy sleeping in a pile of clothes. At first they thought the boy was part of the remains left inside the chamber, but as they drew closer and cast the gas lamps over him, they saw that he was breathing. Their thoughts immediately went to gas intrusion, since children are more susceptible to its effects. Realizing their situation was a more dire one than they had previously thought, they picked up the boy and carried him with them back to their drift tunnel into the lifts that weighed inside the vertical shaft. Now, it should be noted that the appearance of this boy was not unusual back then. It was quite common for miners to take their children into the mines with them to work. These children were given quarter wages and were not recorded in the ledgers amongst those working each day. And here is where some of the stories diverge. As they reached the lift, they rang the mine alarm and began the ascent towards the surface. Progressing upward through the vertical shaft, some of the miners were marked on where the boy had been found. Some said they had found the boy sleeping, half buried in a pile of soft, crushed stone, as is often found in these eroded cavities. Others said he was asleep in a nest of sorts, of old clothes and sacks, almost like he had been there for some time. Most of the miners assumed the boy had wandered over from an adjoining crew, and as he regained consciousness and was shown to be able to stand, he was scolded for wandering in as well as for sleeping on the job. The boy did not speak, but when they reached the surface, he appeared to have recovered fully, and the miners left to notify the foreman of their discovery and the potential dangers of this new passage. Word quickly spread of their finds and of the remains of the deceased miners, but no one in the unit had known of any previous operations in the area. Owaskan was a fairly new settlement, having been established as a mining camp by the Hacklands 18 years prior. The miners left that day without incident and returned home, where the news of the day was passed on to their family members and in the Hackland pub at the center of town. The next part of the story is fairly consistent, as reported by the miners' surviving families. This anecdote comes from Roberta Schull, the wife of Ephraim Schull and the mother of Zeke Schull, both miners employed at the Hackland mine. In the early morning hours came a knock. I thought it was a dream, as it appeared to me to shake the whole house. I woke up and saw that Zeke and Ephraim were already awake and dressed. I had not noticed Ephraim get up. I asked them what was going on, and they said they had to start their shift early. They seemed tired, real tired, almost like they could barely keep their eyes open. I followed them to the door because they had no satchel with them, nothing to carry the lunch loaves I had made the night before. They were empty-handed, but they didn't seem to listen, and this angered me. I said that those foremen are going to work you to death, but they just waved me off. As I was talking to them, another knock came, and Zeke went to the door. When it opened, I'd expected to see one of our neighbors, but there was a small boy there. He was barefoot, kind of pale. I didn't recognize him and assumed that a new family had moved in. Anyway, they left and I saw that there were other men in the street, walking off to the mine. I suppose they had paid one of the boys to run around waking everybody up, but I didn't see the point. They had plenty of labor by then and were typically on schedule. This was unusual. I saw them off and that was it. When they didn't come home that night, I went around to the neighbors and asked them. They said the same thing, that theirs had not come home. We thought that they were being held overtime, which was usually without extra pay, so we got together and decided to go down there to demand that they be let out for supper. When we got to the mine, there was no one there. No foreman, no miners, no shipping drivers. They had a small train at the mine, and when my neighbor Louise checked for the freight conductor, she found no one, but said that the engine was still warm. We were afraid it was the gas again, but Louise knew what she was doing, and she lit a lamp, and we saw that there wasn't any of the green damp or black damp in the air, a fluorescent haze that signals the tunnel has become filled with toxic gas. Though it was okay to breathe, it wasn't until the next day that we were able to find someone from the county over who could operate the lift all the way down to the seam. We never found them. Not to this day has anyone found them. Not a sign. Later, everyone got together to talk about what had happened, and all those in town said the same thing. That they had been woken up early morning, and that the boy was the one who had come knocking.
So what happened at the Sheep's Head Mine? In my opinion, there are several possibilities. Firstly, at the time of the incident, the mine workers were attempting to unionize. The Hacklins had a reputation for squashing unionization efforts with violence, and on that day, by chance or perhaps by design, all the leaders of the union effort were working on that shift. And this might seem the obvious answer to the mystery, but what complicates this and makes it less of an obvious answer is the lack of a cause of death.
Yeah, because we assume that all the miners are dead, but they really are missing. We don't know where they went. There's no sign of a struggle, no sign of a catastrophe at the mine. The mine was safe to go into.
And there was no sign of foul play.
Yeah.
Like we said, everyone on the scene reported business as usual. All the equipment was running properly. There was no gas in the mine. There was no sign of a cave-in or other catastrophe. They simply vanished into thin air.
And it would be really hard to make that many people disappear without a single sign of where they had gone or what had happened.
Exactly. And thirdly, one of the things that makes this such an enduring mystery is the fact that they found other bodies in that portion of the mine. And it's impossible to know how long those bodies have been down there, because in a cave or a mine, when it's dry, and this area of the mine was dry by all accounts, even though there was water intrusion to other parts. In those conditions, a body won't decompose the same rate as a body above the surface because there aren't the microbes and insects to break down the corpse. What we do know is that these people were not part of the Hacklin operation, at least not any recorded members of the Hacklin operation.
Yeah, and what we learned from our research was that there was a neighboring operation on the other side of the mountain by a French outfit called the Bordeaux Mining Company. And they closed up their operation 50 years prior to the start of the Hacklins operation. Now, we don't have any information as to why the Bordeaux Mining Company closed their operation prior to the Hacklins taking it over. What we do know is that they were struggling financially. They may have found that the extent of the coal resources didn't make the operation a viable or sustainable financial investment. Now, what's interesting is that all the evidence suggests that this was an intentional collapse, not a cave-in.
So only questions remain. What was in that cavity? What did the first crew to stumble upon it find there? And why was it closed? And did a similar fate befall the Hacklin operation? We don't know, but when freak accidents happen more than once, we become suspicious.
So that's the backstory of why we're here. And tomorrow we're going to attempt to go into the mine and see what we find. Is that in our car? Is it the same one as before?
It's the same car. What are they doing over there?
They're looking at us. I don't know, maybe I should go say something.
Don't say something. Just wait, see what they say.
Well, they're obviously not going anywhere. They're staring right at us. I think you should get the bag ready, and I'll go talk to them. If I need you, I'll call out.
This is going to make a mess. There's three guys. It's going to make a huge mess.
We're in the middle of the woods. There's nothing to clean up. Who knows? It may be fun.
Fine. Just be careful.
I've redacted this portion of the program to maintain the integrity of the evidence I've collected. What can be heard in the recording seems to be that of three alleged visitors returning again to the two-host camp. The violence that ensues is ferocious and brief. We are currently looking for any information regarding the vehicle these visitors rode, which is currently missing, as well as the identities of those involved. It is clear from the recording that one of the people, likely a male, was kept alive for some time while the hosts torture him. Still, we can only assume the outcome of this attack within the limits of the current evidence. The recording continues here.
And we'd like to thank one of our sponsors, Santorini's Funeral Parlor in Medici, Wisconsin. fulfilling all your funerary and crematory needs. Cash at the door, open 24 hours. Santorini's. We don't ask questions. And when you're checking out, use the promo code HAMHOCK.
We'd like to thank our other sponsor, Junius Cocoplum, the fixer of Foxfield Manor. Fix your tricky situation with Junius Cocoplum's unlimited service plan. Just a phone call away, and Junius Cocoplum will turn your tricky situation into an unexpected vacation. When life intervenes, let Junius sew up those seams. Promo code DEFENESTRATION. Iron Range Shovels, the last shovel you'll ever buy. Iron Range Shovels make light work of any job, and our unique shovel angle makes dislodging rocks, chopping through roots, and conglomerate a small task. An Iron Range Shovel will cover even the biggest mistakes. Iron Range Shovels. When in doubt, dig it out, and bury it deep, deep, deep. Use the promo code LASTSEEN21 at checkout.
Our team conducted many interviews and on-site investigations into the small West Virginia town of Owaskan, though the limits of our resources and the dangers inherent in some of these locations have limited our understanding of the current unfolding events. Though there is much we can't reveal or replay from the program in question, we can say that we have reason to believe that these two men did not leave the mining site via any public or private roads. None of the work of our investigators or the Harrison County Sheriff's Department were able to identify the people mentioned in the previous program. There are no reports of missing persons. The people of Owaskan, West Virginia, are a cloistered community. They tend to handle matters on their own, even if those actions are in violation of state law. One resident, who I will keep anonymous, made a statement that I felt added a confused element to my findings. This resident stated the following, and I quote, "Everyone knows where they went. They're in the mine. It has many natural caves. Some of these you can follow all the way to Ohio and Pennsylvania. Some might go to Kentucky. There was a lost boy in them once, and he came out at the top of the Cumberlands. He still lives here. You can talk to him if you like." When asked about the townspeople mentioned in the program and their supposed disappearance, the resident said this, "We keep good watch over that mine. That's our lot in all this. There's more than a few things that came out of that hole. A few of them we were able to put back. I suppose these two fellows went in hunting for one of them. If they did find one of those old relics, I guess not much good can come out of it. Everyone around here is pretty nervous. We've increased our daily watches." Our investigators pressed this resident about the things that she referenced, but unfortunately, her relatives arrived along with some armed members of the community and ran our investigators off the property. There is much blending of fact and fiction in the stories that the hosts tell during their exploration of the mine. What they describe is frankly impossible, and I refuse to include it here, for both the preservation of evidence and to keep the message of this investigation from getting muddled in the telling. I am left to believe that these communications are not to be taken literally, that they contain some coded message for their listeners. A week later, the hosts of the program emerged, stole a vehicle, and left two more community members, a couple, presumably dead. Currently, we don't know where they are headed, but we do know that everyone should be wary, that we should all be on the lookout.